From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. I'm here from San Francisco for Terry Gross, who's away this week. Scientists around the country are working on the biological equivalent of the Manhattan Project, the attempt to map every gene on every chromosome in the human body. Wall Street Journal reporter Michael Waldholz is following this effort, and today he talks about the promise, the controversy, the discoveries surrounding the Human Genome Project. Also today, stand-up comic and storyteller Frank Maia talks about the professional risks and advantages of revealing his personal life on stage as a gay man. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Liszt Etudes, and linguist Jeffrey Nunberg introduces us to misapprehensions. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Jordan has announced that it's closed its border to refugees from Iraq. Jordan's foreign minister said the country's been flooded with refugees, raising concerns for their health and worries about providing enough shelter. Jordan's King Hussein announced that today alone, 42,000 foreigners had crossed the border from Iraq. President Bush says the U.S. is ready to give the U.N. Security Council more time to enforce the economic embargo against Iraq. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president continued to insist that the United Nations already has the authority to intercept ships believed to be violating the trade embargo, but in the interest of maintaining multilateral support for the blockade, the U.S. will wait to give the U.N. more time to take action.
So my question is, how much more United Nations action is required? And so I'm going to continue the discussion, asking for the advice of my officials here. But at this juncture, I'm not prepared to say whether we're going to insist on UN action before we go further.
But the president emphasized that the United States is not alone in the conflict with Iraq. He said 22 other countries have troops in Saudi Arabia who stand shoulder to shoulder with a U.S. deployment the size of a medium-sized American city. I'm Richard Gonzalez with the president in Kennebunkport, Maine.
A second American serviceman died today during the military buildup in the Persian Gulf. A Navy spokesman said that a 19-year-old sailor was killed in an electrical accident aboard the USS Antietam, which was on its way to the Gulf. He was identified as Daniel Jones of Wakefield, Massachusetts. The Iraqi government has informed Brazil that some 200 Brazilians working in Iraq under government contract will not be allowed to leave until their contracts are completed. Among those being detained are about 30 Brazilian technicians who've been working on a medium-range missile for Iraq. David Wilna has more from Rio de Janeiro.
Iraq's ambassador to Brazil announced the confinement of the contracted workers at the same time that he insisted that Brazil, as a major trading partner, was a friend of Iraq. He said those Brazilians being retained will have to go hungry if the trade embargo with Iraq continues. Last week, after Brazilian officials said they would consider sending food as humanitarian aid, the Iraqi ambassador promised that all of the more than 400 Brazilians in Iraq would be free to leave. That promise was apparently discarded after Brazil made it clear that any food shipments would only be made with the approval of the United Nations. About 80 Brazilians, mostly women and children, have already left Iraq. A foreign ministry official here charged that those forced to stay behind were being held as slaves. For National Public Radio, I'm David Wallner in Rio de Janeiro.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 44 points to close at 2,506.17. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 176 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Sedge Thompson. My guest today is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal who covers one of the great explorations of our time. But this is not an exploration to outer space or under the sea. This is inward, to our cells, to examine the genetic material that shapes who we are and, to an extent, what diseases we'll fall heir to and even what shapes our personalities may be. This is the charting of the human genome, the genetic structure of human beings. Researchers have advanced our knowledge rapidly in the past decade. Michael Waldholz has co-authored with Jerry Bishop a journal of these scientific discoveries called Genome. Now, here's a quick refresher course on genetic biology in less than 30 seconds. Each of us carries all the physical information about ourselves, our height, blood type, hair, eye color, and so on long strands of DNA called chromosomes. We have 23 pair of these chromosomes, and the chemical messages called genes that determine our characteristics reside on these chromosomes. Scientists calculate we humans have somewhere between 50 and 100,000 genes. Since a gene is a conceptual designation and you can't really see one, I ask Michael Waldholst, how is it possible to map them?
Well, to be perfectly honest, there are ways of measuring their presence. And the breakthrough that occurred that has allowed for scientists in the last 5 to 10 years to really go on a gene hunt is a technology called gene markers, in which scientists are able to actually identify bits of DNA. DNA, of course, is the genetic material of which all genes are made. And although there are 50,000 to 100,000 genes in every cell, there is lots of DNA between these genes. Some people call it junk DNA, but it really probably does serve a purpose. And what's occurred in the last 10 years is the ability for scientists to identify these markers. They're sort of like signposts by the roadside that tell these sort of scientific drivers where they are in the DNA. And what's occurred is the ability to follow these markers as they get passed from one generation to another. As these markers are passed from one generation to another, genes that reside near these markers are also passed along. So that really what's the genome project is often referred to as a mapping project, because really what scientists are doing is locating the approximate location, or mapping the approximate location of these genes within the huge mass of DNA within each cell.
I understand that the discovery of these markers and the idea that markers could be used to find genetic material came about through serendipity, through a scientific accident in a way, just a coincidence of scientists passing.
Yeah, you know, a lot of scientific discoveries occur when there is this amalgam of, you bring people together from various disciplines, and one person asks a question and doesn't realize that the answer has already been found in a separate discipline. What's often happens is that scientists keep to their own sort of a little cubby hole, so to speak, and don't get out enough to speak to scientists who might be doing something that provides an important answer. And what happened in 1978 is a group of scientists gathered at a ski lodge above Salt Lake City in what's called the Alta Lodge in the Wasatch Mountains in Utah to do in some ways it was a retreat for graduate students at the University of Utah who are studying various aspects of genetics, to sort of talk about their work and to sort of be advised by some high-powered geneticists from other universities. It so happened that one of the geneticists sitting and listening to the grad students was David Botstein from Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And he understood that these graduate students who were trying to trace the inheritance of certain diseases needed these markers. I mean, he could hear it from what they were saying, that they said, listen, if we had markers all over the genome that we could use as signposts, we could begin tracking down genes. Right now, we don't have them. And Botstein said, and I guess what was a sort of a eureka moment in science, well, we have those kinds of markers. I didn't know anyone wanted them.
Huh. Could the Genome Project have proceeded without these markers?
Absolutely not. And in fact, David Botstein has sort of dropped in and out of the project, these gene hunting escapades over the decade. And he is now at Stanford University and a very, very active participant in the Genome Project.
Why do you call them escapades?
Well, because each gene discovery is in itself a sort of a separate adventure. For instance, we tell in the book, we decide to tell several of these escapades, although we could have told many more. We chose one in particular to start off with because it was the first escapade to use this marker technology in 1983, and this involved the gene for Huntington's disease. Huntington's disease is a terribly crippling illness that strikes its victim in their early 40s to early 50s. Now, people who have inherited Huntington's disease gene are fated to get this illness from the moment they're conceived, from the moment of conception. And yet, prior to the discovery of the gene in 1983, there was no way to tell who had inherited the gene and who didn't. People would know, for instance, that they had a 50% risk of getting the gene if one of their parents had the illness. Now, the escapade itself involved another family, the Wexler family, in particular Nancy Wexler and her father Milton, who began in 1968 to look for the gene when they realized that that Nancy's mother, Leonore, had the disease. But not until this marker technology was created in 1979 did the Wexlers have a way of looking for the gene itself.
My guest is Michael Waldholz. He's written a book with Jerry Bishop called Genome, the study of the attempt to map all the genes in the human body. How do you find out the genetic pattern of someone? What is the ideal sort of research body that a geneticist can use to track down a gene, say a Huntington's disease gene?
Well, you know, initially the primary way that you go looking for whether a disease is due to a gene is by following its pattern of inheritance, by massing together a so-called pedigree or family tree, in which you look at a very large family or you look at a family with many branches, and you follow a particular trait. And if in various generations that trait or disease occurs with a certain kind of pattern of occurrence, let's say 50% of all offspring have the same trait as a parent, then it would be likely to expect that that trait was inherited from that parent.
What makes Mormons so valuable to genetic researchers?
The Mormons, who are based around Salt Lake City and throughout Utah, have become especially important as one of several groups of clans, because they have very large families with extended branches. It was throughout the 19th and 20th century, it was very common for Mormon families to have 7, 8, 9, 10 children, and those children would each have as many offspring themselves. So that for a geneticist who wants to trace a disease as it passed through its family, you would need this very large family. And while, in fact, throughout America and throughout the world there are such large families, what you have in Utah is a very, very large clustering of many of these kinds of families. Not only that, but the Mormons have kept a very close track of their family history going back many generations, so that if a geneticist wanted to know if a particular grandfather or great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather had a particular kind of illness, there were records around describing how that person died, what kind of maladies they had, and from that the geneticist could piece together whether a particular family had this very high rate of a certain disease. And in fact, the Mormons have been very useful to the scientists at the University of Utah in tracking down recently the gene for neurofibromatosis, which is often called elephant man disease.
Genetic studies can often reveal some secrets that families have long kept dark. For instance, if there's been a history of mental illness or some other disease that may not have been fully understood, and an antecedent to grandparent was maybe put into a mental home or died a particularly terrible death, sometimes it's kept a secret, and then it's only through genetic testing is it revealed that perhaps someone actually had a severe form of depression or of Huntington's disease. I was curious in the role that family secrets play in obscuring our genetic history.
Well, in fact, in the instance of, for instance, of the Wexler family, Nancy Wexler's three uncles, her mother's three brothers, all died of Huntington's disease. And in fact, Nancy's grandfather, her mother's father, also died of Huntington's disease. And yet, the actual fact, the reason that they died was kept very, as Nancy says, very hush-hush. No one wanted to admit, I don't think, and especially Leonora didn't want to admit, that somehow she harbored this potentially damaging gene, both for her own personal health. I think it made it possible to live her life believing that she wasn't at risk of having this terribly tragic illness. And she also didn't want to believe that she could have passed it on to her two daughters. And I think as long as there was no medical way of knowing, no test for knowing for sure whether she had the gene and whether she had passed it on to her daughters, I think she could hope as long as she didn't know. Now that we have this test, you have to be very consciously, you very consciously have to make a decision not to get tested. And if you don't get tested and you have children, you have to be very conscious about the fact that you don't want your children to know either.
My guest is Michael Waldholz. He writes about science and medicine for the Wall Street Journal and is co-author of the book Genome, about scientists' attempt to map all the human genes in the body. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest today is Wall Street Journal reporter Michael Waldholz, and he has a book called Genome, about the mapping of the human blueprint in the genetic structure. How did you become interested in the Genome Project?
Actually, I met Mark Skolnick from the University of Utah in late 1985. He was here. He was in New York at Sloan Kettering Memorial Hospital, the very famous cancer center here, doing a sabbatical. And someone had tipped me off that he was here in New York, and that he was someone who was very interested in trying to find patterns of how traits were being passed in families. Actually, I was doing some research in diabetes, and a diabetes researcher said that he had collaborated with Skolnick on looking for large families in which diabetes seemed to run in the family. And he said, if you really want to talk to someone who has thrown himself into this field, you ought to speak with Mark. And he very rapidly, in a series of lunch get-togethers and then longer meetings, sort of began introducing me to this mapping adventure that was being taken place all over the world in very informal projects. It wasn't a formal genome project at the time. My colleague at the Wall Street Journal, Jerry Bishop, was also at the time looking into the fact that heart disease may be caused by the inheritance of certain genes. And when we started discussing at one point the fact that we were both looking into sort of genetics, we decided to do a series of stories for the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And that was the inspiration for the book.
There have been a number of ethical issues raised as a result of genetic information that we now know, ranging from prenatal testing or even what is euphemistically called pre-embryo testing, you know, when the human organism is no more than 8 cells or so in size, to knowledge that we have of our own future in a way by knowing what our predisposition is toward disease. Is there much debate going on within the scientific community or who is actually on the mapping project, or is this a debate that exists outside the genome project?
I think the scientists themselves are now taking a very close look at what is being called the ethical or problematic side of being able to predict the future by looking in one's own genetic profile. It's a very powerful piece of knowledge we're beginning to develop here. And, you know, right now, as I said, no one really knows how many genes there are, perhaps 50,000, perhaps 100,000, and right now, we've only mapped something around 4,000 to 5,000. So it's going to be a while before the rest are found. But the discoveries are coming at such a rapid pace that everyone is beginning to think, well, what's it going to be like when we can take a simple blood test and run a battery of tests and really have what is being called a genetic profile, in which we can see our genetic strengths as well as our genetic weaknesses. We can see some traits which... Clearly, there are going to be traits that are inherited that make some people, that give some people athletic ability, that give people stature, that account for intelligence, and also genes that probably predispose us to various mental health problems, manic depression and schizophrenia, as well as genes that cause very severe diseases such as cancer and heart disease. And being able to do this genetic profile raises a lot of questions. When do you do such a test? Do you do it at the moment of conception? And if you did at the moment of conception and were able to do a prenatal test, what would prospective parents do with that information? How would they decide kind of children and what kind of traits would be good to keep and which kind might be worth discarding.
How likely is it that we can create a super race? Is this
The scientists themselves think it's very unlikely, and I have to agree with them. Because you still have to remember that you couldn't, that parents with very short, people of very short stature who come from long lines of very short stature people would have a hard time finding a gene for someone who might be 6'5" or even taller. So that individual parents are going to have a hard time choosing among their embryos, so to speak, and selecting someone who is a lot different than they are. And in fact, actually taking genes and manipulating them such that we would actually create human beings is something that is so far-fetched that I don't think any intelligent scientist thinks it's possible. More likely is the fact that we will be able to use genetic tests, either prenatally or after someone is born, to tell them the kind of genetic weaknesses they have. For instance, that is believed that there are something like 15 to 20, perhaps 25 genes that help the body process cholesterol. People who have very healthy, so to speak, healthy genes are able to process cholesterol in a very efficient way, and these people probably never will get heart disease. But anyone who had any of these genes in a defective fashion, somehow damaged, either inherited in a damaged form or somehow they were damaged later in life, might have trouble processing cholesterol. And this cholesterol might pile up in deposits in the arteries leading to the heart and could lead to a heart attack. Now, if you could do a genetic test of someone and say, listen, you've of the 15 to 25 genes that you need, you have 8 or 12 or 15 of them in a defective fashion, you're someone at very high risk of developing heart disease. And perhaps from even the earliest age, you should eat a very low-fat diet.
This also seems a way that, say, an insurance company could screen out an applicant, or an employer could say, no, I don't want to have the burden of somebody who has a predisposition toward heart disease or cancer of some kind.
Well, this is a very troubling aspect of the technology. Again, the people who are out there looking for the genes, the people who are trying to cure diseases that are terrible scourges, believe that the benefits far outweigh the potential risks of charting the entire genetic map, so to speak. But nonetheless, we have to face the fact that already we use various pieces of information to screen people out. Insurers already ask people if they have pre-existing health conditions. Employers often give people medical exams before they hire them. There are examples of people who are positive for the AIDS virus who can't get health insurance. What I'm trying to say is that insurers and employers already use information to screen potential applicants, and in fact probably already use other kinds of information to discriminate. We have discrimination of people on the basis of their sex, of their race, and people who are disabled already. I think the concern is that if employers somehow got a hold of a person's genetic profile and saw that, in fact, they were at high risk of developing heart disease or cancer, they might want to screen them out because they might not want these people to incur the high medical bills that they might develop if indeed they ever develop the disease itself. Again, it's a bit far off, but it's not inconceivable, and the technology certainly exists.
One of the people that you follow in the book is Nancy Wexler, who's led a crusade to find the cause of Huntington's disease, the gene for it. Has she herself been tested?
You know, Nancy's been very coy about it. It's not clear to me that, in fact, she has or has not. She certainly won't say. I think she has felt that this is a very private issue. And she, in fact, is now sitting on a committee that is discussing the ethical and legal issues surrounding the mapping of the entire genome. And her committee is attempting to come up with the kind of safeguards that might be needed, whether it's regulations or legislation or some expansion of the Civil Rights Act to make sure that people are able to keep their genetic profiles confidential. Or if, in fact, employers or insurers need to, for some reason, to see an individual's genetic profile, that it not be abused. And I think in her own personal life, she's sort of felt that that if it was known that she was at risk, that information, she might become some kind of a celebrity in a way that I don't think she wants to become. You know, back in 1983, when she led this crusade and the gene itself was located, they don't have the gene itself. They only have a test for the gene right now. They have a marker that can tell whether a person has the gene. I think at that point she wanted to be tested. She was in her late 30s at the time, and although since she had known she was at risk of having this disease, I think she had decided not to ever have a family and not to put prospective children at risk. And I think very quickly she decided, well, I could take this gene and this test and find out if I had the gene and I could have a family. And I think her father and her sister and herself decided, well, what would happen if she or her sister, for instance, was found to have the gene and the other one didn't? I think all of a sudden the consequence of having the gene was something that was something that she didn't want to have to think about. As long as she didn't know for sure, she could always hope that she didn't, if that makes sense.
Well, it makes absolute sense. The idea that knowledge can destroy hope is a terrifying side of this genome project.
Nancy and several others make the point that we're in a very, very rocky period of genetic discovery right now. And Huntington's disease is always used as the example. You can use this gene test now to tell whether, in fact, you will have this terrible illness decades in the future, but there's nothing you can do for it. And as long as you can diagnose for disease, but you can't do anything about it, you're going to have a very problematic time in medicine right now.
Many of the scientists involved in this project view the study of the genome as a crusade. Do you, as a reporter, view it as a crusade, or is this the story for you for the rest of your career?
I think genetics is going to be the most important story in medicine, and I'm a medical science reporter, and I think most all the important stories in medicine beginning certainly for the next 10 years and into the next century will be based on genetic discoveries. I think new drugs will be based on genetic discoveries. Some scientists think that we are on the verge of a new era of medicine, which they call predictive medicine, which a fundamental change is taking place. Some people think that this fundamental change is perhaps dwarfs many of the great medical wonders of the 20th century, such as the discovery of penicillin or the X-ray, because for the first time, doctors will be able not just to, doctors basically right now struggle to fight and treat the sick. With this genetic information, they'll be able to predict an illness before it arises and perhaps even prevent it from occurring.
My guest has been reporter Michael Waldholz. His new book is Genome. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Soviet scientist Joris Medvedev tells us about his research on the legacy of Chernobyl. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sajid Thompson with Fresh Air. Comics talk about and make fun of the things they know. One of the things comic Frank Maia knows about is what it is to be a gay comic in the 1990s. Later, we'll meet Frank Maia. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Franz Liszt's Transcendental Etudes, works that are transcendental and very difficult. And it's been a question throughout the ages, how do linguists relax? Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg introduces us to one way, the game of misapprehensions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Jordan has closed its border with Iraq because of the influx of tens of thousands of refugees fleeing Iraq and Kuwait. The announcement of the border closing came just hours after King Hussein told a nationally broadcast news conference that 42,000 refugees had entered Jordan in one day, the largest number in a single day since the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. Hussein said about 185,000 refugees have crossed into Jordan since August 2nd. Sources at the UN say that progress was made this afternoon over the question of how to enforce trade sanctions against Iraq. The UN Security Council is considering a resolution that would authorize the U.S. and other countries to take military action against ships that try to break the UN embargo. Linda Fasulu of members stationed on UNYC reports.
The five permanent members of the UN Security Council have been locked in discussion since last week over what role the UN should play in the Gulf crisis. The U.S. has proposed a resolution allowing every country to enforce the embargo as it sees fit. The Soviets have been reluctant to approve the resolution. A U.N. source said some of the differences were ironed out this afternoon after a telephone conversation between Secretary of State James Baker and Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze. It now appears likely the U.N. Military Staff Committee will play a skeletal role in coordinating military activity in the Gulf. U.S. sources said today's meeting was a good one and progress was made. The full Security Council is likely to take up the U.S. resolution tomorrow. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo reporting at the United Nations.
Israeli officials have decided not to hand out gas masks right now and to appoint a special subcommittee to discuss the issue. Many Israelis, however, say that they want gas masks immediately. Linda Gradstein has more on the story.
The 12-member defense committee met for 2.5 hours today and decided not to give out gas masks at this point because a chemical attack is still unlikely. The decision was seen as a victory for Defense Minister Moshe Arens, who says that giving them out will make people panic unnecessarily. He also says it might make Iraqi President Saddam Hussein think Israel was preparing to launch an attack. Today's loser was Foreign Minister David Levy, who wants the masks given out now. Many Israelis agree with Levy, and hundreds of people have already bought masks. They are cleaning out bomb shelters and stocking up on baking soda, believed to neutralize chemical weapons. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir tried to calm Israelis tonight, saying the army is ready to distribute the masks quickly should the need arise. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 44 points to close at 2,560.15 on volume of some 176 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, I'll talk with Frank Maia about sexual politics and gay comedy. But first, the 12 Transcendental Etudes by Franz Liszt are supreme tests for a pianist. The pieces are extraordinarily technical, but just hitting the notes isn't enough. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Russell Sherman is one of the few pianists who can make the etudes sound like music.
In a biography of Liszt, Alan Walker wrote that the 12 fiendishly difficult tone poems for the piano that make up the Transcendental Etudes require, above all, a pianist whose technique is so advanced that he succeeds in communicating their simplicities. On Russell Sherman's new disc of the Transcendental Etudes, he doesn't exactly make you forget how breathtakingly his fingers master Liszt's overwhelming challenges. But he also convinces you there's a lot more to these pieces than a lot of notes, that Liszt arranges all those notes into coherent and dramatic structures, at the center of which is a powerful, perhaps profound, simplicity. Sherman's playing never loses the narrative thread. He leads you from incident to incident, and each of the etudes has its own character and color. Sherman is not afraid to confront the sentimental and melodramatic sides of Liszt, but because they are part of an ongoing drama, they never seem ends in themselves. In the etude Ricordanza, for instance, Sherman shows how Liszt's embroidery of trills and lacy runs is a kind of ironic fantasy of nostalgia, an elaborate frame around an empty photograph. Sherman calls it the human gift for inventing a past to defray the present and banish the future. In Harmonie du Soir, there's no irony, only a sublime calmness with which Liszt reaches for the stars. Sherman admits that in Mazeppa, he's troubled by the structural obviousness of the corny plot, a Cossack's wild ride at the end of which his horse collapses in exhaustion. Yet Sherman seems to love exploring the way harmony, texture, color, all the musical images keep changing, developing, unfolding in phrases, sentences, and paragraphs. And he reveals a mania in the music that is much more powerful and disturbing than mere melodrama. Sherman's storytelling power is just as great in the two etudes that have no descriptive titles. He plays for contrasts as well as continuities, and he makes the transitions from piece to piece an important part of this musical drama. So after you are, in Sherman's own words, pounded into submission by Mazeppa, you can lose yourself in what he calls the transcendent grace and whimsy of Feu Follet, which means will-o'-the-wisps. Sherman's entire performance has unstoppable momentum. After those arpeggios that range the entire keyboard in the opening preludio, it's impossible to stop listening until the last shivering snowdrift of the 12th etude has whirled itself out of existence.
Liszt's Transcendental Etudes, Lloyd Schwartz reviewed a new recording of them performed by Russell Sherman on the Albany Records label. This is Fresh Air. In the tradition of Spalding Gray, Eric Bogosian, and David Cale, Frank Maia emerged from New York's downtown performance scene. He dispenses his form of humor, observations and monologues about his dysfunctional suburban family, current events, and gay politics, mostly on small stages and now on cable television. He'll appear this weekend on Ha! Comedy Network's The Talent Pool. Maia first went on stage not as a comic, but as a rock singer. During intervals between songs, he started doing short monologues he called rants. They garnered mixed reactions.
Well, it depends on where I was. I was one time at the Bottom Line, which is a fairly conservative club where people come in, they expect rock and roll. And we had the audience, we were opening for the Waitresses, remember that group? And we really had the audience going good. And then I just kind of stopped the music. I took out some paper. At this time, I didn't memorize anything. I just used to read it. And all these kind of guys from New Jersey just saw me. I said, I'm going to read some poems. I used to call them poems or rants or whatever. And they were funny, but they didn't know that. And they just started yelling out, why don't you just kill yourself? We don't want to hear poetry. And they were screaming and yelling. And I always persisted. That never stopped me. And usually they started liking them. And almost always they started liking them. By the time I finished with the rant section of the show, they were screaming and laughing. You know, it made me realize that I had that I liked to make people laugh. It was fun to make them dance, but it was more fun to make them laugh.
One review of that time described your humor as being gay. And the review, I understand, you kept in your scrapbook, you scratched the word gay out.
Yeah, actually, not a scrapbook. I always tell that interview it wasn't a scrapbook. But in my press kit, yeah, I edited that review. I couldn't believe it. I think I was the first person ever to be outed. I really do. I think I have that distinction in the Village Voice. Probably not. But anyway, I remember it was also around 83, And I can't remember who did it, actually, in The Voice. He just came right out and said, he was a gay writer himself, and said, I wish his songs were more openly gay romantic. And I scratched out gay and just made it romantic. So there was a time, even though I constantly hinted about being gay, you know, in my act, constantly in the songs even, there was always things built in there that a lot of people got, a lot of people didn't get, yet I was very close-mouthed about it, and I was horrified by that review.
When did you decide, and how did you decide to become openly gay as a comic performer?
I really only decided to do it this past fall, in September. Like I said, it was always in the work. It was always in the comedy. There was lots of hints about it, and gay audience members would pick up on those hints and get a kick out of it. But a lot of straight people didn't. And I was preparing for a show that I was hoping to take off Broadway. I had a manager who was working with me, and it was August. We were doing a lot of tryouts in little clubs. And one night I got up. I had been watching a lot of HBO specials. I was sick in bed. I had the flu. That's my big story. I had the flu for like 3 weeks, summer flu, very sick, watching HBO specials, right? And watching people that I like Roseanne Barr and other people who are, they're up there for an hour talking about every part of their life, you know, talking about their husbands, their kids, their love life, growing up in high school, love in high school. And I'm thinking, I never talk about this stuff because I'm not allowed to, or I feel like I'm not allowed to. So one night, in the middle of the night, 3 a.m, I got out of bed and I thought, that's it. I'm not going to put up with this crap anymore. I went into the kitchen. I wrote the entire, what I call the gay routine in my show. It's called The Fury. Almost word for the way it is now, the way we did it in the TV special. And I started doing it that week.
Do you fear being booked as a novelty act rather than as a gay act or a comic act?
Well, that could happen, I suppose. That'll be an interesting part of my life. A novelty career act.
Yeah.
It happens so easily, it's true. I think that the show would never allow that, my material wouldn't allow that to happen because really, I think what my whole show is about it's about growing up in suburbia. It's straight people can relate to it. Gay people can relate to it. Even the gay material in my show, I think a lot of people can relate to it because it's about the human condition in general. I talk about my relationship and so forth. So, no, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think the material is not silly, and I think it's not novelty-ish.
Oh, no, it's a pity being gay. The other fun thing is telling your parents. Oh, yeah. I mean, for my generation, you know, a lot of people just, like, really... Now, these days, I know kids tell their parents, like, when they're 12 years old. You know, like, I'm gay, that's it. They walk out of the house, they get a job. I didn't tell my parents until last year. Okay, on the phone. I was very nervous. I wasn't really worried about my mother, but my father is really serious Catholic, you know, and Latin, too. As a matter of fact, I think he's gay, too. And I said to him, I said, Dad, look, I'm gay. That's it. I don't want to talk about it anymore. And there was this big silence, right? And the first question he asked me, I swear to you, he goes, let me ask you a question. Is Mayor Koch gay? I think we had like a list or something, right? Oh yeah, I was with him last night at Uncle Charlie's. You know, we were dancing together. You should see Ed with that tambourine, right? Oh, I'll ask him tonight. And the second thing he says to me, he says, listen, your mother and I will pay any amount of money to get you to a doctor, to get you a cure. I said, Dad, you know there's no cure except fame.
There are some shoes that you wear that are sort of very strange looking black shoes. And I wonder if this is a part of your costume and if they're special shoes for you on the stage.
That's interesting. They're not that strange, but I know they look strange on television. No, they're the first real expensive shoes I bought for myself in my life. They actually look like Oxfords. They're really kind of like nerdy looking black tie shoes. But I noticed on TV, they shine so much that they look kind of gigantic or something.
There was a curious look to them, and I just wondered if that was intentional.
No, it was intentional, yeah. To be really hip.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, of course you were.
Of course, you know. I've never been, like, really big on really dressing up for shows, you know. And coming from the downtown performance art scene where people have elaborate costumes, I mean, I just get up there in black jeans, you know. And so I bought these expensive shoes, you know, to try to make... And people liked them at the TV taping, but their reaction was kind of like yours. They said, what are those shoes? And I thought they just were complimenting them. I guess they look weird. Unintentional.
There are a number of comics who are gay but choose to keep their... sexual orientation private, yeah. Not bring it into their act. They say it doesn't matter whether they're gay or not. But you clearly have chosen to take another tact. Mm. I wonder why.
Oh, I think it does matter. I think it matters a lot. Now, some people's material doesn't have anything to do with anything. Okay, they're doing jokes. It has nothing to do with anything. And those people are right in a way. I mean, in another day, I guess another era without AIDS, where gay people are dying and people are being quiet about it, too quiet about it sometimes, I think I would agree with some of those people. It has nothing to do with their job. You know, I used to have a therapist who told me that all the time, a gay therapist who told me that it's no one's business whether I'm gay. I believed that for a while. But I think today, it certainly has a lot to do with my work, okay, because I grew up, you know, most straight men growing up did not do productions of Cleopatra in their basement, I think. Okay. So for me, being gay connects to everything in me. It really does. And I think the other important thing that we can't, if everyone took that attitude that it's not important, then every gay person would be invisible again. And that would be terrible.
Is there some humor, some kinds of shtick that you avoid because it would take you into the world of camp more than contemporary commentary that you seem to do?
Yeah, I don't like camp stuff that much. I mean, I like drag queens and all that stuff. I mean, people doing... I always say I don't do Bette Davis imitations, although watching that TV show, when I read that letter from Bette Davis, I think I sound like her a little bit. I'm turning into Bette Davis.
Well, it sounds like maybe an homage.
Yeah, it's like real... That's all it is. I like that stuff. I think it's funny, but I have never... I don't come from... I don't feel like I have a stereotypical... gay sensibility. Now, I'm not saying there's nothing wrong with that sensibility, but I don't think it's the only sensibility. There's drag queens, there's guys who do camp humor and cabaret, and then there's other people who sing rock songs, who do comedy, who are actors. We're all different forms of... That's what gay men and women... That's why I protest a little bit when people think that maybe I do campy humor, you know, when they hear that I'm gay, the gay comic or something, you know, all this... There's nothing. I don't reinforce any stereotypes, I think, in my show, I hope.
Your heritage is what, Colombian Irish?
Yeah.
Irish Catholic?
Irish Catholic.
You also include, then, Catholic humor.
Yeah.
I guess, in the Pope and so forth.
Sure. How could you not? Most people like to laugh about this. I think it's kind of fun-loving and warm.
Are you developing material specifically for gay audiences?
Yeah, I think I am. I wasn't planning on. When I did this gay routine, this like 10-minute thing, I just thought, I'm just doing this one thing. The rest of the stuff will just seep in. I'm not going to. That's it. I'm just telling the audience I'm gay. In the middle of the show, I tell them I'm gay, and we go on with the rest of the show. Now I feel like that's a cop-out. I feel like I would like to do. I like the idea of what Richard Pryor did. I'm sorry, I just hit the microphone. I like the idea with what Richard Pryor did in his show. He talked a lot about the black experience that white people couldn't share, but they could listen in on. And I wouldn't mind doing that. But I don't have a big enough gay audience to do that with yet. I'm developing the material. You know, I mainly try it out at the gym. But that's where I have my biggest gay audience right now. But I'm slowly getting a bigger gay audience, you know. I don't want to lose my straight audience either. I mean, I like to see all audiences together, but I wouldn't cop out and just do middle-of-the-road entertainment that only talk to straights or, you know, or say only talk to gays. Not that that would be middle-of-the-road.
Well, Frank Maia, thank you very much for coming and being
Thanks,
a guest
Ed,
with us on For Sure. Thanks.
Thank you.
Frank Maia appears on The Talent Pool Sunday night on Ha! Comedy Networks. This is Fresh Air. Later here on National Public Radio, today's edition of All Things Considered, and host Robert Siegel has graced us with his presence for a preview. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Sedge. We'll be hearing today about President Bush's remarks and his announcement that reservists will be called up. Also, why things aren't moving any faster at the United Nations on approval for military action. King Hussein's remarks that the United States misled the Saudis into thinking that Iraq was poised to move on their country. And as Americans have now been interned in Kuwait, occupied Kuwait and Baghdad, we'll hear about the internment of German and Japanese diplomats 50 years ago in Washington. They were taken to a plush hotel out in the country.
That's all on All Things Considered, later here on National Public Radio. Our minds can hold song lyrics, movie titles, and Shakespeare quotations, but sometimes we mix the words up. A while ago, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg and a friend made up a game of what we remember and what we think we remember.
Ever since our college days, my friend Parker's been a repository of ephemeral facts about sports and popular entertainment. What most people call trivia, but what he prefers to describe as detail. I stopped trying to stump him a couple of years ago. We were talking on the phone, and I said, "Oh, I had a rock and roll question for you, but I've forgotten it. I can't even remember what the answer was. All I can remember is that the answer was not the Platters." He didn't miss a beat. Got it. What you wanted to know is who sang Deep Purple, and the answer is Billy Ward and the Dominoes. At that point, I wisely retired from competition. But the episode did lead to the short-lived game of misapprehensions. It's a kind of second-order Jeopardy. You're given a wrong answer, and you have to guess the right one. Example, the answer is not the Beach Boys. Correct response, the question is, who sang the Little Old Lady from Pasadena, and the answer is Jan and Dean. Some of the best misapprehensions questions involve who said what. To take an example that's too easy for serious play, the answer is not Play It Again, Sam. Of course, the right answer is Play It, Sam, which is what Humphrey Bogart actually says to Dooley Wilson in Casablanca. Or, the answer is not Gild the Lily. The right answer to that one is Paint the Lily. It's from Shakespeare's King John. to gild refined gold, to paint the lily, to throw a perfume on the violet, etc., 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 is wasteful and ridiculous excess. It turns out that there's a rich vein of misapprehensions like these. In The Merchant of Venice, Antonio says the devil can cite scripture for his purposes, not the devil can quote scripture. Coleridge's Ancient Mariner really said, water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink, rather than, and not a drop to drink. And Lady Macbeth actually says, screw your courage to the sticking place and not to the sticking point. Not that either version makes much sense today. The satisfaction of games like this one is that they provide an outlet for all the stored up information you can never use in everyday life. Because even if you know the original form of the line, civility prohibits you from quoting them that way. If you try to say, paint the lily instead of gild the lily, people simply assume you've made a mistake. This can lead some people to add a little clause of explanation, like, that's just painting the lily, to quote the phrase in its correct Shakespearean version. Does anybody really care that you know these things? Besides, the popular versions are usually improvements on the originals. What David Farragut actually said at the Battle of Mobile was not damn the torpedoes full speed ahead. He said, damn the torpedoes, Captain Drayton, go ahead, Jewett, full speed. But it's hard to imagine that version ringing down through the annals of naval history. And what Horatio Nelson announced to the fleet before the Battle of Trafalgar was actually, England confides that every man will do his duty, using confide in the old sense of be confident. But a signalman changed confide to expect, and Nelson made it into Bartlett's by the skin of his teeth. Or should I say with the skin of the teeth, which is how the line actually goes in the Book of Job. No, by the skin of your teeth is a much better way of expressing the idea of getting there by the narrowest of margins. Nelson Signalman was one of the unsung heroes of the collective consciousness. Literature becomes proverbial for the same reason history becomes myth. It's a way of correcting the mistakes and omissions of the past. Washington should have cut down the cherry tree, and Frankenstein should have been the name of the monster. And if they ever remake Casablanca, you can be sure that this time around, Rick will say, play it again, Sam.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning. Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tuohy produce the interviews on Fresh Air. Our office is held together by Dorothy Farabee. For Terry Gross, I'm Sedge Thompson.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the legacy of Chernobyl with Joris Medvedev, the exiled scientist who's followed Soviet cover-ups of nuclear disasters. Also, an author who believes in the power of garlic to help writers. We meet Jim Harrison, author of the new collection of novellas, The Woman Lit by Fireflies. That's next time on Fresh Air.